Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. Bring down the temperature, said President Biden to Americans in the febrile political atmosphere that followed Donald Trump's election victory. But his advice could equally apply to the more than 100 heads of state and government gathering in Azerbaijan for the UN's annual climate summit known as COP29, especially since 2024 is predicted to be the warmest year on record. World leaders had previously pledged to stop the planet from heating by 1.5 Celsius from pre-industrial levels by the end of the century, but it's looking likely to be roughly double that. And if the numbers don't convince the sceptics, maybe the climate itself will, with an increasing number of extreme weather events caused by human-made global warming. Europe, Asia, Africa, and the Americas have been affected by killer storms, heat waves, and floods. More than 220 people were killed last month in the Spanish region of Valencia in one of the worst floods in Europe this century. The BBC's Nikki Schiller described the scenes.
In front of me are dozens and dozens, probably hundreds of cars, all tossed in the air and in the middle of the street. There is debris everywhere. There are blocks of concrete that have been thrown around. There are bits of trees and the mud. It is thick, it is dirty, and it is smelly. And it has inundated the people's houses in the street.
And firefighters in Southern California this month battled wildfires as the US state suffered what is being described as a particularly dangerous weather event. The local fire chief, Dustin Gardner, gave this update at a news conference.
We've got sustained winds more than 50 miles an hour with gusts over 80. Every firefighter in the region, all of our partners from Los Angeles City, Los Angeles County, Orange County, Kern County, Santa Barbara County, our partners at CAL FIRE, our partners in the sheriff, every law enforcement agency available, every helicopter, every fixed-wing aircraft, everything we've been able to get a hold of is here fighting this fire. And it is moving at a dangerous rate of spread. Bushes are burning, grass is burning, hedgerows are burning, agricultural fields are burning, and structures are burning. These aren't one of those fires where you can wait and predict and maybe stay home. Your homes can be replaced. Your lives can't. Leave.
Back in May, a devastating landslide on a mountain in Papua New Guinea after weeks of heavy rain killed hundreds, perhaps thousands of people. We heard then from Mate Bagosi, the UN's humanitarian advisor in Papua New Guinea, who'd visited the area.
We found a scene of complete desolation, I must say. Populations affected are understandably traumatized. The landslide is very, very deep. Has covered 6 to 8 meters of depth almost everywhere, which makes rescue efforts very challenging. In addition to this, the landslide is still moving slowly, which makes rescue very dangerous.
Some examples of extreme weather events in 2024. And let's hear first from Adil Najam, Professor of Earth and Environment at Boston University. He's also president of the Worldwide Fund for Nature. Professor Najam is on his way to COP29 in Baku. What does he expect will be discussed?
They're going to be discussing a lot of things. And for some of us, the fear might be that we'll be discussing so many things that, like the previous 29 COPs, we will end up with a lot of talk and very little action. But the biggest thing on the agenda, at least for this COP, is what's called climate financing, which is how do we fund, particularly in the poorest, most vulnerable countries that are at the front end of the impacts, but haven't been the major causes. How will we fund the actions that are needed? And now, because we are so late in doing this, how will we fund the damages and the loss that is happening, right? So 10 years ago, the funding question was, how do we fund things so that this doesn't happen? Now that climate change is happening, as your report just pointed out, in every continent of the earth, right? You gave us three examples from three continents, but it's every continent. How do we fund the action that is needed? It's very urgent, but I do not think the COPs have a very good track record of doing what they are supposed to be doing.
Will the summit end with any kind of commitment on the reduction of emissions?
That is not on the agenda per se. right? And frankly, if you think about what has happened to the commitments that we've made before, for example, in Kyoto, for example, in Paris, you just pointed out very rightly, there is no science I know which tells me that we are going to meet the commitment of 1.5. Right. So in a way, that's my worry is not that it won't have a commitment. My worry is that on the things we have committed already, will there be action or not? So in some ways, I think this game of making future promises, which is what we did at Paris, which is what we did at Kyoto, which is what we try to do at Copenhagen, people have perfected it because future promises are far cheaper and far easier than doing action today.
A forthcoming change in the United States in the administration, is that something that is concerning those gathering in Azerbaijan?
Oh, it's clearly concerning a lot of people. And if you hear the chatter, or not just on media, social media, people who are going there, that's very much top of the mind because it is such current news. But again, I come back to this urgency question. It is not as if when we didn't have this change, right? When last year, for example, in Dubai, or the year before that in Egypt, or the year before that in Glasgow, when we didn't have this change happening, it is not as if we did a lot of stuff and now we won't be able to. It is much more than that, having not done what we are supposed to do. By we, I mean particularly the high-emitting richer countries that are the primary cause of this. Having that track record, is this going to make it even more difficult? But to me, I think we should look at the process and we should look at what the process can give, but have this laser focus on action today rather than promises tomorrow.
That was Adil Najam, Professor of Earth and Environment at Boston University. And let's look more closely now at climate financing. What's the evidence that the high-emitting countries are ready to dig deep into their pockets for the money needed to compensate nations for the loss and damage they've suffered as a result of climate change? Back in 2009, they agreed to pay $100 billion a year by 2020 to developing nations to help them ditch fossil fuels and adapt to a harsher, hotter climate. On the line, Laurie Goering, a London-based climate change journalist who's covered many of the COPs since 2007. And Laurie, firstly, has that pledge made in 2009 been honored?
Well, it has, but it's been honored 2 years late. The pledge was that there would be $100 billion a year delivered starting in 2020, but it took until 2022 for the countries that had agreed to mobilize that money to actually deliver it, which was a source of a lot of frustration for them. But that goal ends at the end of this year, and they are supposed to now set at this COP a new goal that would be for an upcoming period, maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years, but to try to mobilize much more money because of the kind of problems that we've been hearing about all over the world and the urgency of trying to get new clean energy in place and to adapt to some of the changes that are already happening.
So we've moved from adaptation and mitigation, am I right, to compensation for loss and damage, and that means a far larger bill?
Yeah, it's very complicated, actually, because we're still definitely working on mitigation. We're definitely working on trying to get adaptation increased because we're seeing these impacts happening. But at the same time, there was a recognition that were some things we just can't adapt to anymore because the impacts are so big. And that's where loss and damage comes in. Now, what they're supposed to do at this COP is set what's called a new collective quantified goal for climate finance. That's something that is in all the agreements that have come up so far. But most of the countries that are providing this finance don't want loss and damage finance included in that. They say that's something separate, and that because the key parts of the Paris Agreement say this is about adaptation and mitigation. But a lot of the poorer developing countries say, no, this is all part of the same thing. This is clearly part of the same aim, and it should be included in the goal.
So that's the first point of difference. But I would imagine there'll be another in terms of which countries pay up.
Absolutely. You know, traditionally, it's been the rich developed countries that are expected to create and generate this finance, either from their own budgets or mobilizing it from other sources, including private sources. But it's clear that they're not able to mobilize, or they're saying they can't mobilize as much money as is needed, because the demand is really going up. You know, we've had this goal of $100 billion a year. Now what's being talked about is somewhere in the order of $1 trillion a year. You know, that's a pretty big mm-hmm. step up. And so richer countries are saying, okay, we're not going to be able to do that from our budgets for a variety of reasons. So we need new players to come in, you know, China, India, South Korea, which has not been a big donor up to now, and, you know, a range of other countries. But there's been some resistance to that, obviously.
I mean, from what you're saying, it would require China and maybe India to be reassigned as emitters, as developed countries, if they're to contribute to this fund rather than being recipients of it.
Yes, I mean, under the Paris Agreement, there are what are called differentiated responsibilities, and there's an argument that some countries might be moved along the spectrum to being not just recipients but donors of this. But, you know, it's a really, really difficult question, because if you look at historical emissions, while China is the world's biggest emitter right now, you know, the U.S. is a much, much bigger one in historical terms. And so there's lots of arguments about what, you know, who should be on which side of the divide. And that's a very difficult thing to settle. That's not going to get settled at COP29.
Can you imagine the Trump administration signing up to this new collective quantified goal, which is a phrase I suppose we're going to have to get used to this week?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that's the essential problem. There's been a lot of difficulty with the developed countries meeting that 100 billion goal. If we're asking them to do something that, you know, is on the order of 10 times that, and we have, you know, I think the U.S.'s contribution is, you know, somewhere roughly in the order of 10 billion, you know, and that disappears out of the, you know, the pot. Who's going to make up this and vastly increase this? Now, the rich countries say that we're going to turn to private finance. And it's true, you know, you can get businesses to invest in some things like creating new renewable energy, because there's an income source from that. But adaptation is much harder, and loss and damage, there's no return on.
Laurie, look, many thanks. I've got to end it there. That was Laurie Goring, a London-based climate change journalist who's covered many of the COPs since 2007. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. More than 3,000 people have been killed since Israel began its assault against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Southern Lebanon has been largely emptied of civilians, but Israel does continue to attack targets across the country, including in the capital, Beirut. In the latest attacks, at least 23 people have been killed in an Israeli strike north of the capital, while Lebanese media have reported another Israeli strike on the eastern city of Baalbek. This resident of Beirut said the rest of the world just didn't seem to care.
I feel sorry that the powerful countries aren't looking at us as people, as human beings. The world has been stripped of humanity. They talk about animal rights and other rights, but they are abandoning humans who are dying before their eyes.
But even as the fighting with Hezbollah and airstrikes continue, the incoming Israeli defense minister, Israel Katz, struck a triumphant note.
We defeated Hezbollah, and the elimination of Nasrallah was the highlight. Now our role is to continue with the pressure and to finish the job. And here we will work together to realize the fruits of this victory by changing the security situation in Lebanon.
But what does the minister mean? I asked the BBC's John Jonathan in Jerusalem.
Well, there's a bit of a contradiction there, isn't there? Because saying you've defeated Hezbollah, but saying they need to continue applying the pressure and finish the job doesn't quite match, does it? And just before the ceremony which Mr. Katz was attending for the new Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar, we actually had a barrage of 15 rockets being fired into northern Israel by Hezbollah. So the fighting is ongoing. That said, I do think there is a real push now from the Americans to try and get not only a ceasefire deal in Lebanon, but also one in Gaza. And I think in the next few weeks, in the dying days of the Biden presidency and with Donald Trump imminent in the White House, a man who has pledged to end the conflict in the Middle East, Benjamin Netanyahu, who has stepped over America's red lines really for much of the past year, might be ready to listen.
Do military commentators say what Israel has achieved in southern Lebanon, in Lebanon as a whole, indeed?
Well, they have clearly absolutely decimated the Hezbollah leadership, not just Hassan Nasrallah, but basically the entire senior command structure of Hezbollah underneath him. They have caused widespread destruction in southern Lebanon in particular, but also in the Bekaa Valley, and they have been taking out weapons, stores, rocket launching sites, infrastructure. So they've done a lot, but we know that before this conflict began, it was estimated that Hezbollah had some 150,000 rockets and missiles, some of them capable of reaching all parts of Israel, and I would be surprised if all of that has been destroyed. But they've clearly been hit very, very hard indeed. It does seem like Israel might be reaching the point where it's prepared to say they'll stop.
And I notice that Benjamin Netanyahu has spoken to President-elect Trump a number of times in the past couple of days. So there does seem to be a warming of relations between Washington and Tel Aviv.
Yeah, I mean, it's no secret, really, that the relationship between Prime Minister Netanyahu and Joe Biden was lukewarm at best. And although America under President Biden offered Israel staunch support, really, over the past year, the two men clearly didn't see eye to eye. The American administration under Biden has become increasingly frustrated with Israel, and I think Benjamin Netanyahu sees that he now has a real friend in the White House. However, as we know, Donald Trump is unpredictable. He has said he wants to bring these two wars to a close, as well as the war in Ukraine. And if Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't go along with him, you could see that relationship, I suppose, between the two men souring.
That was the BBC's John Donison in Jerusalem. To Madagascar now, and some inspiring examples of how people are helping protect their local environment and their own livelihoods at the same time. The second largest island nation in the world lies off the coast of Southern Africa, and nearly 90% of its plants and animal species can't be found anywhere else in the world. But much of their habitat is being destroyed, jeopardising the wildlife and the food sources many of the island's nearly 30 million people rely on. Sarah Therige has been to meet some of those finding ways to help.
Most farmers don't know how to keep the soil fertile, so they burn whatever is left of the forest to plant on the fresh land.
This is Tanya. She created an organization that's trying to fight this problem by teaching farmers how to grow food and trees at the same time, addressing two of Madagascar's biggest problems at once, deforestation and food insecurity. Together, we're visiting a hillside just north of the capital, Antananarivo, where she and the farmers are running an experiment, turning this dead patch of land into a special kind of forest that will help feed plenty of families in this area.
So, for example, this here is an avocado tree, and around it they've grown vegetables.
Like this, the water will be stored there. Then we plant fruit trees in the hole and vegetables around it. We also plant lemongrass to stabilize it and other crops to nourish the fruit tree. The key here is to ensure the water doesn't just flow away.
This is Tanya's home. Her small orange brick house is surrounded by a lush food forest where every crop and every tree serves a purpose. And sewage from her house waters the soil. Tanya and her husband trained over 60 farmers across the region who now use these methods The World Wildlife Fund estimates that more than $140 million is lost every year in the Southwest Indian Ocean to illegal shrimp and tuna harvesting. And there's one ethnic group in particular, the Vesu, whose survival really depends on the ocean's health. They're a tribe of nomadic fishermen, but now more and more are forced to set up their lives on a remote group of islands, because that's the only place where they can still find fish. This is the biggest of a total of 9 remote islands, a simple sandbank in the midst of the ocean, without trees or fresh water. I'm here to visit Amilson and his father Gervais.
When we first arrived here generations ago, the nature here was really healthy. There were seagrass beds and coral reefs. But now so many people are fishing here that our natural world is suffering.
Normally, the Vesu take everything they can from the sea until almost nothing is left. But now some of them are using their exceptional diving skills not to fish, but to protect the ocean by monitoring fish stocks and convincing their communities to adopt more sustainable methods.
If the coral ecosystem degrades, the fish living there will flee, and that's a really scary thought. If our resources die, our Vesu culture will disappear.
Amilson and the other divers were trained by Blue Ventures, a marine conservation organization. They now work almost autonomously, diving 1 week a month and leading regular meetings with their community to discuss how to react with new local policies. Their ultimate goal, creating the largest locally managed marine protected area in the Western Indian Ocean.
That report by Sierra Terige in Madagascar, and you can hear more about these projects on People Fixing the World, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. There's a lot more to come in the next 30 minutes after a summary of the latest world news. You're with NewsHour. And Russia has been courting African countries this weekend at a summit in the Black Sea resort of Sochi, with President Putin promising the continent total support. Russia has been growing in influence in Africa in recent years, including militarily. Three West African countries, Niger, Mali and Burkina Faso, have turned their backs on former colonial power France since coming under military rule and pivoted towards Moscow, while Russian mercenaries from the Wagner Group or its successor, the Africa Corps, now support several African governments. Dr. Socha McLeod is a professor at the University of Copenhagen, who used to be with the UN's Working Group on Mercenaries.
Well, we've seen Russia's influence grow in the African region quite substantially, really going back to probably about 2017 when the Wagner Group first appeared, and it expanded from Central African Republic, from Mozambique into Libya, Mali, now into Sudan, into Burkina Faso, into Niger. So we have seen Russian entities operating and providing combat services as well as multiple other services in lots of different African countries in return for access to natural resources, so gold, diamonds, timber, uranium, pretty much any kind of natural resource that you can think of. And they have, in providing these combat services, these fighting services to fight terrorist activities or insurgency activities, they've been involved in really severe human rights abuses to the extent that they've been accused of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity.
What makes Russia a more attractive partner to these countries? And I'm thinking here particularly of Niger, Mali and Burkina Faso, rather than in the case of those countries, the former colonial power France.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. And I think there's definitely been a pushback against France in particular. But we've also seen that UN peacekeeping forces have also been asked to leave. We've seen that in Mali, for example. And essentially what we're seeing is that Russia is creating a sort of neocolonialism. It's reestablishing links with West African countries in particular that it had historically. You know, if you look at Mali, for example, Mali had a long history history and long relationship with the former Soviet Union. And I think what we're seeing is under Putin, we're seeing a push to recreate that Soviet empire to support African countries through the provision of fighting services, boots on the ground, is to assert geopolitical power and, as I said, to try and create a new Russian empire. But it's also about getting access to the natural resources. Russia is in dire need of access to things like diamonds and gold, etc.
That was Dr. Socha McLeod, Professor of Law at the University of Copenhagen, who used to be with the UN's Working Group on Mercenaries. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from the BBC in London. And we return to our top story. The UN Climate Summit, which opens tomorrow in the Azerbaijani capital, Baku. As we heard earlier, of concern to delegates are the prospective energy policies of the incoming US administration, led by a man who's described climate change as a hoax. During his last presidency, Donald Trump pulled the US out of the Paris Climate Agreement, which set legally binding targets for CO2 emissions, and is reported to be preparing to do so again after President Biden rejoined. And then there's Mr. Trump's refrain of drill, baby, drill during the campaign, which will have been music to the ears of fossil fuel companies. Let's hear first from John Hart, co-founder and vice president of C3 Solutions, or the Conservative Coalition for Climate Solutions. Have I oversimplified Trump's attitudes towards climate change?
I think you have in some respects, and I'm going to offer a more optimistic take on this debate. I think what you're going to see with the new administration is a group that's going to argue for economic freedom and bottom-up solutions. So C3 Solutions put out a report a couple years ago called Free Economies or Clean Economies. And what we did is we did a deep dive research on every economy in the world and looked at their index of economic freedom as measured by things like low taxes, less government, efficient systems, and so on. And we did an overlay with the Yale Environmental Performance Index and showed that the free economies were twice as clean as the less free. So the Trump administration, I predict, is not going to lead with a climate change is a hoax message as much as to the extent that CO2 emissions are a risk, then we ought to embrace policies that lead to bottom-up innovation, energy abundance. And that suite of policies will lead to the emissions reductions that I think people want to see around the world that COP is certainly going to discuss. And I think your previous guest hit on all of the same issues that are always talked about is there's future promises, future targets, but what matters far more than future promises are today's policies. And I would reassure people that I think the Trump administration, they are going to support an energy abundance agenda.
Well, but you mentioned that a couple of times. Energy abundance, that means greater use of coal, oil, fracking.
Energy abundance means if we know as a species that what drives innovation is more energy and cheaper energy, and it's a counterintuitive principle. So, for example, I live on a farm outside of DC. Okay. When I look out my window, I see mountains that 150 years ago, they were clear cut, and a lot of the UK was clear cut. And what saved the trees during that era was something called coal. So now that we've burned coal, we've realized there are byproducts that are negative of coal. But the economic activity generated by that energy source has led to new breakthroughs, new innovations, such as nuclear, small modular nuclear reactors, cleaner ways of using fossil fuels, whether it's carbon capture, whether it's fracking. And I think what the Trump administration is going to say is there is no reverse gear in economic history. The degrowth agenda is an anti-human agenda that will lead to incredible suffering. Back at the last COP, you know, the chair famously said that if we got rid of fossil fuels today, we'd all move back into caves. And so there would be an apocalyptic scenario of moving overnight away from fossil fuels. And so again, and even Kerry Emanuel, very esteemed climate scientist at MIT, has said that India is going to have to burn coal for a while in order to lower CO2 emissions. That is counterintuitive, but he's correct. And when you think about Africa, You can't ask a continent to decarbonize that has never carbonized. There are ways to help Africa move very quickly to a position where they can do that more efficiently, but that's really going to be the mentality of the Trump administration.
And would you expect the green transition to continue under President Trump?
I think so, but I think it's going to look very differently. It's going to be described in a very different way. I think what President Trump is going to do is support an all-of-the-above energy strategy. He is going to support far more fossil fuel use than many people on the progressive left would be comfortable with. But at the same time, he's going to lower barriers to other renewable companies. Elon Musk is a great example. You know, he's being vilified now because he supported Trump, but he obviously founded Tesla. He's not a climate change is a hoax person. He's an innovation person. So you're going to see it easier to deploy these next generation technologies. Nuclear is the break the glass solution, if you will, if you really want to lower emissions quickly. And it's a very complicated, it's, you know, easier said than done. But if you can have tech companies do a regulatory bulldozer and get those deployed, you can have great change very quickly.
That was John Hart, co-founder and vice president of C3 Solutions. And listening to that interview was the esteemed climate scientist from MIT, Professor Kerry Emanuel, who was quoted by Mr. Hart in support of his argument as having said, India is going to have to burn coal for a while in order to reduce CO2 emissions. Professor, did you say that? And if so, what did you mean?
Well, not quite. What I meant was this, that among many of the drivers of increasing emissions is, in some parts of the world, increasing population. And we know from recent history that the way to control increasing population is to make people wealthier, particularly to give them more energy. So I speculated once, and it was sheer speculation, that if the target is to have the minimum amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, say by the year 2070, it might counterintuitively be a good idea for India to burn a lot of fossil fuel energy to get their population wealthier, to control that so the emissions a few decades later drop off a lot. But it is speculative. But my whole point there, though, was that we need to tackle a lot of important problems simultaneously: population, poverty, and energy, and of course, climate.
Do you subscribe to John Hart's thesis, which he seemed to be suggesting could very well be adopted by President Trump?
Well, I'm guardedly optimistic, and I'll tell you why. That very quietly during the last 4 years, in addition to the high profile of things like the Infrastructure Act, which, by the way, poured a lot of green energy money into Republican districts, and I think that Republican politicians will be reluctant to give that up. But aside from that, quietly, there were a lot of bipartisan, very strongly bipartisan measures taken to put us on the road to clean energy, particularly with more intelligent regulation of nuclear energy and promotion of things like small modular reactors. So I'm kind of optimistic that we're quietly moving forward. And I agree with your previous guess that we're going to have to put a lot of nuclear power in this mix if we're really going to decarbonize our economy.
We heard earlier that COP29 is likely to be dominated by climate finance. Whatever happened to targets for the reduction of CO2 emissions?
I think the problem with the targets is that they're a little bit arbitrary, and we really haven't been successful in getting many of the developed economies to abide by them, and Germany being a primary example.
And is that why the world's getting hotter?
Yes, the world's getting hotter. Things are getting worse. There's no question about that. The question is, what's the fastest route to decarbonization? And I'm optimistic because of the examples of several countries, notably Sweden and France, now 40 or 50 years ago, decarbonized their electricity completely, did it in less than 12 years with no perceptible dent into their economic growth. They did that with hydro and nuclear. So if they could do it then, the experiment's been done, we could do it now. It's a question of removing roadblocks to that.
Do you see Donald Trump pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement again? And if so, what would be the implications?
Well, I have no idea about that, to be honest with you. I do think that the thing that is encouraging to me is that there is bipartisan support, I mean, really bipartisan support for doing certain things that I think are key to decarbonizing, regardless of what agreements might be reached under the COP process.
So very briefly, if I can use the term, the ecology in the United States has changed since the first Trump presidency.
Are you talking about the political ecology? Or are you talking about the natural?
I'm talking about the political ecology.
Yes, it certainly has. But I think that, you know, there's the high profile stuff, whether you pull out of COP or not. And then there's the things going on quietly in the background that are stimulating innovation in green energy and moving it forward. So that's the basis of my optimism.
Professor, many thanks. That was Professor Kerry Emanuel of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And we go now to Amsterdam, where back in 2009, a 19-year-old sex worker named Betty Jabo was found stabbed to death in the city's red light district. She'd recently given birth. Although police immediately launched a murder investigation, her killer has never been found. But Dutch police have reopened the case, and central to this fresh bid to find the killer is a 3D computer-generated image or hologram of the murdered teenager projected from behind a window in the red light district. We contacted Alina Ruvers, spokesperson for Amsterdam Police, and she gave me some more details of that hologram.
So the hologram is actually a computer-generated visualization of Betty. And in the hologram, she reaches out to onlookers or passers-by asking for help. And with the holographic representation of the victim, we used 3D techniques. And at some point, you can actually see a cloud appearing with the word help. But there are loads of cold cases. And her case always have had our attention, especially because of the extremely tragic circumstances about Betty's death. And that has to do with the fact that she was so young in the brutal way in which she was murdered. No police officer was able to let go of this case. So when our Amsterdam cold case team reviewed her case, they decided, okay, we really want to make a final attempt to solve this case.
I mean, for most of the people passing by and seeing this hologram, they're seeing a complete stranger. But to a lot of sex workers in the red light district, they're seeing an image of somebody maybe they knew, somebody who was a friend. And maybe that's quite upsetting.
Well, the responses so far have actually been really positive. A lot of people also nowadays knew Betty and her story and are really eager to help solving this case. We would really like to emphasize actually the fact that it is never too late to talk. We know from research that people who commit a crime like this usually tell multiple people about what they've done, which means that we assume there are actually people that know more about her murder. And since it has been 15 years ago now, mutual relationship might have changed over time. And we think that this might now result in people to be more willing and open to talk about what they know or have heard. The red light district is one of the busiest places in Amsterdam and also one of the most international ones. So this is why we really specifically want to reach out to people from abroad. Is there anyone who knows more? Have they perhaps visited the red light district on that very day, the February 19th, 2009? Maybe they even remember visiting Betty herself.
That was Alina Ruvers, spokesperson for the Amsterdam Police. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. In a desert in northeastern Africa, you'll find a country that is home to the most pyramids in the world, and it's not Egypt. It's Sudan, currently engulfed in a civil war which has so far claimed the lives of more than 60,000 people and displaced about 11 million. And that war is slowly encroaching on the pyramids at Merawi, a former capital of the ancient kingdom of Kush. Soldiers from the Rapid Support Forces, which are fighting the Sudanese army and its allies, have already stolen artefacts from the Sudan National Museum in Khartoum, and they're getting closer to the pyramids. The Sudanese-British journalist Zainab Badawi is the author of An African History of Africa. She's been telling me more about the pyramids at Marawi.
In total, there are about 1,000 pyramids in Sudan, and about 200 of them preserve their superstructure in some shape or form, and some are actually standing. And the ones in Merawi, which is the ancient city of Merawi, about 200 kilometres north of Khartoum, and actually it's now known as El Bajrawiya, it's not to be confused with the modern city of Merawi. I mean, if you go there, you go through a long drive through the desert from Khartoum, and, you know, dwellings are diminishing in number. And then suddenly, set against these reddish brown hills, dozens of pyramids suddenly appear. Some of them don't have their pinnacle, and others are actually tipped rather incongruously and restored by concrete. And these pyramids are smaller than the ones that exist in Egypt. Early in Sudan's ancient history, in the north of the country, the dead were buried in tombs adjacent to the pyramids, but then later on they began to bury the dead inside pyramids, just like the ancient Egyptians. These pyramids, you know, would have been full of treasures and goods for the dead to use in the afterlife, but sadly, of course, they've been desecrated and plundered over the centuries. And it's just absolutely tragic that we are witnessing this possible, you know, mass destruction of Sudan's cultural heritage in the modern era.
You've already said that the pyramids at Merawi have already been looted. I mean, what is the threat to them if the fighting between Sudan's warring factions gets any closer?
I mean, the pyramids themselves are just, you know, structures. So per se, they're not going to, presumably, unless somebody just wants to, you know, wanton damage and just start destroying them, because they don't obviously contain any jewels and treasures today. They're all kept in the museums. The real threat is to the museums, the recently renovated National Museum in Khartoum. There are other museums dotted around the Sudan, and it's the principal one in Khartoum, which houses the treasures of ancient Sudan, which has already been looted. I mean, it's heartbreaking that this has happened. There's gold jewellery like bracelets and necklaces, exquisite ceramic potteries which are enamelled, which date back thousands and thousands of years.
You feel that the Merawi pyramids themselves are safe, but the potential threat to them is indicative of the general threat to Sudan's cultural past represented by the current civil war.
Absolutely. The fighting in Sudan has shown that there's no regard for human life. And so I do expect that there's going to be respect for ancient monuments. Really, why would there be, when you are confronted with such, you know, a terrible conflict, that I would just hope that these structures, that people don't just, you know, for the sake of it, just want to destroy them. I mean, I just hope that nobody will, you know, think it's worthwhile destroying these structures.
Sudanese British journalist Zainab Badawi, author of An African History of Africa. We're derived from the martial and artistic traditions of African slaves brought to the New World by the Portuguese. The street dance of capoeira is one of Brazil's most iconic art forms. Though many of the capoeira masters who developed the dance in the 20th century struggled to find fortune in their home country, things seem to be changing, with a new generation working to ensure that their legacy is not forgotten. BBC Brazil's João Fellet reports.
Nestled in the heart of Pelourinho, the historic centre of Salvador, is Lua Rasta's Capoeira Museum. Lua's museum is filled with instruments he collected as he spread capoeira around the world, from West Africa to Switzerland and Thailand. Like generations before him, he says he felt liberated by the art form.
Boy, I was too oppressed. That's what led me there to capoeira, you know?
Based on the traditional dance of those brought to Brazil in bondage, the art form has had a difficult relationship with the country of its birth. One of the grandfather of modern capoeira was Mestre Pastinha,
Eu era capoeirista. Também tinha capoeirista que andava torto.
He was born in 1889, 1 year after slavery was abolished in Brazil. The year after that, capoeira was outlawed in Brazil. By the time Pastinha died, capoeira had become emblematic of Afro-Brazilian culture around the world. Sadly, he would also die lonely and penniless. João Grande was one of his pupils and took up his mantle as a capoeira master. Like his teacher and so many other masters, he struggled to make it pay in his native country. He tells me how he had to give up capoeira and get a job washing cars. Eventually, he would leave for New York, setting up an academy there that thrives to this day. But in Brazil, the cycle repeated, with many of its greatest names forced to emigrate for a better life.
We forgot about the people who moved, who made the culture of this country happen.
Sabiá is one of the next generation of capoeira masters.
I always saw all these masters in extremely fragile situations during the end of their life cycle. There was always a small fund to pay for burial or to give some kind of medical assistance.
In spite of the struggles of many of its leading lights, there is room for optimism regarding the future of capoeira in Brazil. Historically reserved for men, increasingly, women are helping to ensure the art form thrives. Nani is the granddaughter of Master João Pequeno and now runs his academy.
My grandfather always said, "My daughter, capoeira is ready. It doesn't need anything. What it needs now is for you to continue."
That report by the BBC's João Fallet ends this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.